Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Who's in Charge Here edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 7th, 2009, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Free Enterprise Fund versus Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. The question in this case is whether provisions of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which established the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, violate the Separation of Powers Doctrine, the Appointments Clause, or both. To discuss the case, we have Villanova University School of Law Professor Tuan Samahan. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Samahan.
Hello, my name is Tuan Samahan at Villanova Law School, and I will be discussing a potentially very important facial separation of powers challenge to the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, SOX, as I'll refer to it, which made further inroads on the unity of executive power. I will also assess the reaction of the justices at the oral argument to the petitioner's claims. At base, the central separation of powers concern presented by the case is the degree of control that a hierarchical superior must be able to exercise over another officer. Both the removal and the appointments issue present different but related aspects of this issue of control. First, the question presented was whether SOX violated the separation of powers by vesting PCAOB members with executive power while stripping the president of control of that executive power. And second, were the PCAOB members appointed consistently with the accepting provision of the Appointments Clause? That is, are they inferior officers, and further, is the multi-member SEC a head of an executive department? Congress enacted the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002 following the Enron and WorldCom accounting scandals. Title I established the PCAOB to oversee the audit of public companies that are subject to the securities laws in order to protect the interests of investors and further the public interest in the preparation of informative, accurate, and independent audit reports. The five board members are appointed by the SEC after consultation with the chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve and the Secretary of the Treasury. The PCAOB has the power to register public accounting firms, establish auditing and ethical standards, inspect, investigate, and sanction registered firms, and set its budget, which is funded by annual fees. Importantly, the PCAOB members are removable by the SEC only for cause. As to the first question, the formalists on the court appeared skeptical that the president remained in control of the executive power exercised by the PCAOB. In the case below, D.C. Circuit Judge Kavanaugh had referred to SOX as Humphrey's Executor Squared because the PCAOB is even better insulated from presidential control than the now familiar multi-headed independent agencies that were upheld in Humphrey's Executor. Two firewalls separate the PCAOB from the president. The SEC commissioners may remove the PCAOB members only for cause, and the SEC commissioners have traditionally been thought to be removable by the president only for cause. Petitioners and their amici argued that the president effectively has no power to control the PCAOB members. They are unremovable, and they are unappointed by the president. At oral argument, the justices gave some hint to how they would resolve the case. Justices Scalia, Roberts, and Alito all expressed concern about the attenuation of executive control. Solicitor General Kagan protested, perhaps too much, that SOX had not moved an inch beyond Humphrey's Executor. Interestingly, because it was not briefed by the parties, several justices, including most significantly Justice Kennedy, questioned what had been a standing whopper of an assumption, that there are, in fact, two firewalls to presidential control of PCAOB members. Their questions suggested that there is only one firewall, and that, so understood, the PCAOB was no different than any other independent agency. Justice Breyer, joined by similar questioning by Justice Kennedy and Justice Sotomayor, asked whether any statute prevented the president from removing SEC commissioners at will. Indeed, no statute specified any limitation on presidential power to remove. The sole statute that implied any limitation was the provision for fixed terms for SEC commissioners. But a statute providing for fixed terms does not necessarily say anything about whether the president may remove an officer. It may indicate only the quantum of damages available, such as those awarded in Wiener, that an ousted officer may seek. Or alternatively, a fixed term may indicate only that a president may appoint the successor only to the remainder of the term being served by the outgoing incumbent. On such an analysis, the president may remove SEC commissioners at will, and the SEC commissioners can remove PCAOB members only for cause, an arrangement that does not, on that view, attenuate presidential control any more than already allowed in Humphrey's executor. That analysis would avoid deciding for now the constitutional question of whether double barriers to removal violate the separation of powers by attenuating presidential control over executive officers. Justice Scalia noted with irony that the government would hardly consider it a great victory if the Supreme Court upheld Sarbanes-Oxley only by concluding that the SEC was not really an independent agency. On the appointments matter, the appointments issue will give the court an opportunity to clarify a messy inconsistency on who counts as an inferior officer for the purpose of the accepting clause. In Morrison v. Olson, the functionalists, pragmatists, and common law constitutionalists on the court bent over backwards to save the constitutionality of the independent counsel provisions of the Ethics in Government Act. The Morrison majority adopted a balancing approach to deciding the question of who constitutes an inferior officer by asking whether an officer was lesser or less powerful in the abstract. The court weighed sundry considerations such as an officer's tenure, an officer's safeguard against removal, an officer's duties and jurisdiction, to determine whether an officer really was inferior, again in the sense of lesser. Justice Scalia was the lone dissenter, with Justice Kennedy recusing. Justice Scalia's approach would have adopted the view that it is necessary for an officer to be subordinate to a superior, to an appointing superior, in order to be considered an inferior officer. In 1997, Justice Scalia's view got its due when Chief Justice Rehnquist, the author of Morrison v. Olson, assigned Justice Scalia the majority opinion in Edmund. Justice Scalia clarified that to be an inferior officer, generally speaking, is to be a subordinate, that is, to be directed and supervised at some level by others who were appointed by presidential nomination with the advice and consent of the Senate. This formulation of inferior as subordinate had been rejected by the court in Morrison, but adopted by the court in Edmund. Interestingly, for this case, Edmund never explicitly overruled Morrison. But it is clear that the debate has now shifted. In the PCAOB oral argument, none of the justices peddled Morrison's inferior officer balancing test as the relevant standard. Edmund's subordinate standard now appears to govern. Depending on vote counts, we may see the court clarified that Edmund had sub silentio overruled Morrison on this point. As a result, many of the questions during oral argument focused instead on Justice Scalia's Edmund construction of what it means to be subordinate, that is, directed and supervised at some level by one's appointing officers. The justices explored minutely the relationship between the PCAOB and the SEC and aim to ascertain whether the PCAOB members are indeed subordinate to the SEC. Justices Ginsburg and Breyer indicated by their questioning of the challengers that they considered the SEC to have a supervising relationship with the PCAOB, effectively preventing the PCAOB from doing, quote, anything that doesn't have the SEC's approval, unquote. The challengers, for their part, emphasize that the PCAOB's investigative powers are not subject to SEC supervision and direction in their exercise. The board has statutory authority distinct from the SEC. Moreover, the SEC lacks the power to supervise and direct by removing the board members except for cause. This presents a conundrum for the court's functionalists, who doubtless favor the constitutionality of the appointment. How can the SEC be said to be an agency independent of the president when no statute explicitly prohibits the SEC commissioner's removal, and yet the PCAOB be said to be subordinate to the SEC when a statute quite explicitly prohibits their removal except for cause and gives the SEC no part in supervising their exercise of investigative functions? In conclusion, then, Free Enterprise Fund versus PCAOB presents the court with an opportunity to clear up its inconsistent accepting clause precedents by declaring that Morrison versus Olson's approach to who is an inferior officer is dead. It also presents the court with an opportunity to elaborate its holding in Edmund by specifying what level of supervision an appointing officer must exercise over an appointee. The court may end up avoiding the removal question by concluding that the president has the power to remove SEC commissioners, thereby removing the second obstacle to presidential control of executive functions. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.